This episode is brought to you by State Farm. If you're a small business owner, you know that it isn't just your business, it's your life. And whatever your business might be, you want someone who understands. That's why you might want to check out State Farm Small Business Insurance. Why? Because State Farm agents are small business owners too, living and working in your community. That means they know what it takes to help you personalize your policies for your small business needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
Wow, that guy means business.
Just an amazing player.
No, not him, the sports photographer behind him.
What?
He has a business bank account with QuickBooks Money where he earns 5% annual percentage yield. So he's scoring big on and off the field. You might even say he's the MVB.
MVB?
The most valuable business.
Making your money work harder. That's how you business differently. Intuit QuickBooks. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank. Member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Hi, I'm Kara Swisher, editor-at-large of Recode. You may know me as someone who spends all day on Slack making new emojis of Peter Kafka's face, but in my spare time, I talk tech, and you're listening to Recode Decode on the Vox Media Podcast Network. Today in the red chair is someone I've wanted to talk to for a while, April Underwood, the chief product officer at Slack. She's been at Slack for 3 years now, but before that spent nearly 5 years as the director of product at Twitter. Lots to talk about there. We're taping this episode in late August, but releasing it just before the Slack Frontiers conference in San Francisco. April, welcome to Recode Decode.
Thanks so much for having
me. So there's so much to talk about. What I want to do, you guys just raised a whole bunch of money. There's been all kinds of, Slack has done a lot of stuff in the past couple of years. So let's just get your backgrounds. I'd love to understand how you got to where you got. Obviously, it goes without saying you're one of the few really high-ranking female leaders in tech. There's not as many as there should be. And you've worked at a lot of these places that are obviously creating a lot of news. So I'd love to get your thoughts on that. But first, give people a background of how you got to where you got, because I think it's very important to understand people's origins.
How we got here. Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't have necessarily been able to predict that I'd end up here. I would say I'm from Texas. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Amarillo, Texas, which is in the Panhandle. Mm-hmm. If you'd ever driven down I-40 and seen the big signs for the restaurant that offers a 72-ounce steak for free if you eat it in an hour.
No.
That's where I'm from.
Okay.
For our listeners who have driven across the country on I-40, there you go. So I grew up in Amarillo. I was lucky to go to Montessori school and, you know, my parents were very focused on education. Mm-hmm. But, you know, growing up in that place, the helium plant was one of the biggest employers there. There was not a lot of technology. And right. So I really didn't grow up knowing that this technology, industry existed. But I did have a real interest in computers. I don't think I realized it. I think to some degree, I just was a little bored. But but we got a computer when I was a kid and I'd play games, but I'd also do kind of weird things like I had a baseball card collection. And so I typed all the metadata from my baseball cards into a spreadsheet so that I could sort it so that I could easily find out whether or not I had, whatever that Texas Rangers baseball card was or so have you. So, in a different environment, maybe now I would have been pretty clear that actually I was really unnaturally interested in technology and computers, but I didn't pick up on it. I don't think anybody really did. And I went off to college at University of Texas in Austin, and I chose chemical engineering.
UT.
Yeah, that's right. Hook 'em horns.
I should have worn my t-shirt today. I have one.
I bet that would have been an honor. Mm-hmm. So I went to UT. And because I'd done well in chemistry in high school, I thought, well, then I should be a chemical engineer. Mm-hmm. And the first time we were going to visit a company to learn a little bit about the roles, we had to get a hard hat and steel-toed boots. And that was the first sign I had that I actually knew nothing about chemical engineering and learned that it was a lot of oil and gas.
It's big in Texas.
It wasn't that interesting to me. So, I went to University of Texas at Austin in part because I had a good number of scholarships there. And financially, that was really important for me to be able to do college. And I gave them all up because I realized that it wasn't the right thing for me. And so I got to work doing what I've pretty much always done my whole life, which is I went and got a job. And I went in the Texas paper and the campus paper. There was a job that paid $10 an hour, which sounded pretty better than the waitressing and barista jobs I'd had before. And it was doing tech support for internet service providers. So
this is while you were at college.
This is while I was in college, my second semester freshman year. And so I started working on the side, and I was helping people reinstall their modem drivers so that they could get on the internet.
The trick was I had to teach them
how to do this complicated technical thing, and then they would have to hang up the phone, and it's sort of like good luck, you know, because they mostly had one phone line. So, you know, I think that was the first point at which I started to think more about software. I taught myself to code so I could get off the phone and start creating the training modules for the other employees. And I started just realizing the extent to which, you know, these products were really powerful, but also were really, really hard to use for a lot of people. They did it anyway because they were so useful. People wanted to be online, but the experience was, you know, needed a lot of work. So that was the point at which I decided to go into software and became an engineer. I worked at Intel. I worked at Travelocity. I transitioned into product management.
Moved to California.
Yeah. Well, so I graduated in December of 2001. So, you know, on the morning of 9/11, for example, we actually had a speaker in one of my classes from Southwest Airlines. And just none of us even knew what to say. We were we had no idea what had just happened. And so the economy, you know, it was really, really falling out. You know, I had the opportunity to interview with Intel, and I'd always, always wanted to live in the Bay Area. We didn't take a lot of vacations when I was a kid, but we'd come to the Bay Area once, and I just was obsessed with it. And so I wanted to come out here, and I had an interview with Intel in Santa Clara. And it was the same day as my graduation. So I decided not to do the interview, and I said, well, just send me to the next closest place. And I assumed Oregon was just the next exit off of the freeway from San Francisco. And so I ended up in Oregon working for Intel, assuming I would spend a lot of time here. And then once I actually looked at a map, discovered that that was a little impractical. So I worked there for a while. I transitioned to Travelocity back in Texas to spend more time with my family. And I was an engineer and became a product manager, ultimately because I started asking a lot of questions. I was being asked to code things, specifically Travelocity powered the travel tab for Yahoo Travel at that point. And I started asking business questions about why we would pay so much rev share to Yahoo for these bookings and so forth. And in doing so, you know, kind of found my path towards product management. So so that kind of brought
people
me to how
quite
I ended
understand
there.
What product management is, I think, what it really does, because it's a combination of technical and business, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also a role that has changed a lot. I think it roughly changes every 5 years. So product managers are ultimately responsible for picking the right things to build and then bringing definition to them. And in doing that, what I mean by that is understanding the customers, understanding the market, and then taking, you know, a principled but also like rational point of view as to, well, we should do this first. And then once we do this, then, you know, we can do this and it's going to unlock these business opportunities. And so you really do have to be able to have the technical aptitude to have some sense for what's feasible. You need to have the business orientation as to like what matters, but then you also need to understand users. And so, you know, when I got into product management in the early 2000s, there were a lot of women in it. It was more of a business function. It was considered more of a marketing or a GM kind of function. And, you know, we can get into it, but it's been really interesting to see how I think Google had a phenomenal impact that actually brought it much more technical. And then I think with the rise of mobile, design became more important.
Absolutely.
So it's a really interesting role in that you're sort of always having to evolve yourself.
Evolve yourself, absolutely. So you worked at Travelocity, and then how did you get to Twitter?
Well, so I worked at Travelocity for a few years. And at that point, actually, I made the transition into product management. But before I did, I was told I needed an MBA to be a product manager.
Okay.
So I thought, okay, well, that sounds straightforward. So I applied to business school. And then I got into product anyway, but I also got into business school. So I went to business school at Haas, and which is UC Berkeley's business school. And I was a little disenchanted with tech at that point.
Yeah.
You know, this was 2005.
Why? It's early. You weren't in it for very long.
Yeah. You know, but
was
sometimes,
the dude thing,
sometimes people
there,
around
so
the age 25, you know, have
quarter
questions
life,
about
call it.
questions
you
about what they want
life.
To do. But what was interesting is when I went to business school, then YouTube came out and got acquired by Google. The iPhone came out literally while I was in school. So I was in school from 2005 to 2007 when basically the whole new era emerged. And so then I would like fell in love with it again.
Facebook, exactly.
It came out my second year of business school. Which I only knew about because my sister was in junior high or high school or whatever, and so I was using it. So I went to Google after business school. I interviewed with them. I was in a role where I was focused on all of the work that we needed to do to ingest the content that couldn't be crawled on the web. So content was a really critical thing because of Google's mission to organize the world's information. And so, the data that powered local search on maps, the data that powered, books search, et cetera, for all of these different properties. So I had this really interesting, but in some ways very narrowly scoped role. And what I realized only afterwards is that I got to work with all of the initial teams that built all of those Google properties so many amazing people that are, that I'm lucky to know and be friends with and get to work with today were there during that era. So I showed up to the Google party a little late. I liken it to showing up to, I showed up in 2007 and it felt late. It felt like showing up at a party after the crush of people has left maybe they're running low on certain supplies. Yeah. The rosé is, is out.
You missed the billionaire period.
I did. But I also left Google a few years later thinking that Google had sort of done what it was going to do. I looked at all of the things they were working on. I was like, this is done. And I was obviously completely wrong.
Right.
But for me, that opened up the opportunity that then I made the leap to a small startup. And then I was there for a few months. And then I had the opportunity to join Twitter. And I made the leap and joined.
So what compelled you to Twitter?
I love the product.
Yeah.
Twitter for me, I started using it in 2007, but really in 2008. And I was living in Noe Valley at the time. And I started getting connected with people who lived in my neighborhood because of Twitter. Twitter was small then.
Right.
But this idea that, this is still when mobile and mobile apps were new, but this idea that this website or this mobile app could actually help me connect with the people that actually were in local proximity to me in a place that I'm not from and where I, didn't know my neighbors and that sort of stuff. That was just absolutely amazing to me. And so I really loved the medium. I loved the fact that people were smart and witty and interesting on there. I loved the pace at which it moved. And so I just loved the product. And when I got the call from a friend who joined, I had gotten to know Dick Costolo when he was at Google during his stage. He was over there, and then I got the call from a friend, and I belabored the decision a little bit because I was working for a great startup, but I followed my heart, ultimately, because I didn't go there because I thought, this is going to be this company that's going to go public and all that sort of stuff. I truly went there because I love the product.
A lot of hopes at the beginning, I remember.
Yeah, it was a different time.
Yeah. Because they were Odeo. I remember when they were Odeo before that, which was really interesting. And then they kept switching CEO. Then you just could see the problems, I have to tell you. We'll go into that later. But so because I want to talk about tech responsibility and things like that. You guys are less pulled into the debates going on right now, but still have to be thinking about them. And so you were there, and through the period of its mega growth, really, right?
Yeah.
And you worked on what?
Yeah, so I joined when we were about 150 people, and by the time I left, we were 4,000 over the roughly 5 years. So I joined to be a PM on platform, worked on things like the tweet button, the follow button, all of these tools to make it easier, ultimately, for publishers to be able to get their content shared easily by users into the network. And so so worked on that for a while, but I also wore a lot of different hats there. When you're at a company through that kind of growth stage, sometimes the fact that you've been there a while becomes such a unique asset.
Absolutely.
And institutional knowledge is so important that you actually get the opportunity to try out different roles. So I started doing product, but we had relationships with Google and Microsoft and Yahoo, the search deals, and we didn't have anybody really responsible for them. I also had been at Google. So I ended up building out a good portion of the business development team and then getting back to my major, which was product on the ads and data side over my last 3 years there, and built the ads API and program around it and so forth. So, so I through my course there, I led product teams, I led business development teams. I also led product marketing for ads for a while too, just out of the need.
Yeah, so the reason I want you to talk about this is I want people to understand that switching is really shifting. And especially when you're a woman, you can do that to try to grab for what you want kind of things.
I am actually somebody who is pretty, I hold on pretty loosely to the idea of like which function I do. And I think that served me well. So, you know, there have been times in my career where I've been, where people didn't believe I was a product manager. So when I was at Google, I wasn't a product manager because I don't have a computer science degree. And I was there during an era where there was a pretty narrow view as to what it meant to be, like what was required. And the most important thing was to gain credibility with engineers. And so you had to have that like stamp of approval. I'd been literally an engineer, but because I hadn't, it was a real blocker for me. And, you know, what I've found is that rather than exiting the industry, instead finding those adjacent opportunities and also, frankly, getting to build teams from scratch or getting to learn new skill sets like I did during my 5 years at Twitter, it's so important to me and what I do now because as CPO, I'm not just responsible for, you know, the actual organizations that roll up to me, I need to have a really broad purview.
That's right.
And the fact that I've done a bit of marketing, the fact that I've done deals, it makes me a better partner.
Yeah, it makes you smarter with the people when they come to you. You know, I remember dealing with someone and he was, I think it was Terry Semel when he was running Yahoo, and he was like, you know, the Yahoo search team tells me we're better than Google. I'm like, you're not, like, of course they tell you that because they couldn't get hired at Google. And it was a really interesting discussion. I was like, you don't know, like, you don't, you know, what you don't know what you don't know, which I think is a problem with a lot of executives, I have to say. You know, they don't understand everything. So if you know sort of how the sausage was made, you sort of do understand when people are taking shortcuts or they're not telling you the right thing or they don't, you know what to look for, I think, is critical. So how did you get to you were at Twitter during crazy period and Slack, what happens?
Yeah,
I had met Stuart when he did the photo thing at Yahoo.
He's been around.
Did that disastrous game thing that turned into Slack. And, you know, that's the story of this, of what happened here. And so I'd gone up to Canada, to Vancouver, to visit him when he was doing the game thing. What attracted you to Slack?
So what attracted me to Slack actually kind of started back in 2007 when I joined Google. So so I joined Google out of business school. And at that point, one of the big hiring pitches was transparency. So, you know, this idea that, you know, every Friday afternoon you're going to come to TGIF and you're going to hear directly from Larry and Sergey, which was amazing. And then also this idea that you can sort of know anything that's going on within the company. And it was already a sizable company. And so, you know, you would join and you would start, you know, hearing about different projects and you could just join the mailing lists for almost anything that was going on within the company. And this whole idea of transparency then, you know, during those years, a lot of companies in the world were like, hey, what's Silicon Valley doing? Like, how can we be more like them? How can we shift to more transparency? It seems like it's driving a lot of innovation. Ideas are coming from anywhere within the organization. But ultimately, the tools were not the right ones for them. So, you know, in my years between, you know, 2.5 years at Google and then 5 years at Twitter, it was this culture of transparency, but the tools were just completely wrong for it. Because in an email world, you don't decide, you know, ultimately you don't really decide what comes into your view. Other people decide that for you. When every single time you want to share something with somebody, you have to decide who the right people are to receive it. You have to, you know, give it a subject. You have to, like, it's all this pomp and circumstance to be able to communicate anything. And so it's very high friction. And near the end of Twitter, I was actually thinking about these ideas of like, why did Twitter work? And Twitter worked because you could tune into the things you cared about and there was no cost to unsubscribe. But we didn't have that for person-to-person communication and work tools. And so, you know, as I was leaving, I was thinking about these concepts a bit from my own experience of having just been in an email culture that's just crushing. Where like you wake up every morning and you have so many emails that you don't get out of bed until like 30 minutes after you wake up because you're just trying to figure out, is there anything in here that's important, which is also a problem that, you know, of course, Slack helps solve with notifications and the ability for you to configure your view of Slack to focus in on the things that are most important. So, you know, so I was thinking about these problems. I left Twitter. I took the first break in my entire life since I was, you know, 15 and a half or whatever the legal age was to start being a hostess at the Black Eyed Pea in Texas. And during that time,
that's some good eating.
Yeah. It's talk about quality control. I mean, I think a lot about quality control now with Slack. We care a lot about what we launch, but my first quality control job was making sure that the chicken fried steak would extend over three sides of the plate because otherwise it was not.
Can't have that.
It was a Texas-sized chicken fried steak, and that's the only criteria.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so attention to detail. Yeah. Important. Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, I took some time off. Mm-hmm. I launched hashtag Angels with five of my colleagues from Twitter, which is an angel investing group that maybe we'll talk about later.
And I
forced myself to take some time off. And during that time, I met Stuart. And long story short, he was looking for a head of platform. I've worked on platforms pretty much my entire career. We hit it off. I was what he needed. The role was really enticing and exciting, and the company was an interesting phase. And they were working on a problem I actually cared about.
Right.
So it made it really straightforward.
Right. And then you just went. You thought this is the way it goes. And it was really fascinating that to me that no one had ever thought of this works. It was a version of, there were versions of it. I forget all the names of the thing. I saw so many versions of Slack. And I'm blanking on all their names. But I remember me. I remember one guy had a good tan. And I forget the guy who ran that company.
I missed the tan.
Microsoft bought it, I think.
Yeah.
There was a lot of that idea of taking, and Facebook had even thought about doing Facebook for work. And AOL 100 years ago, you aren't going to remember this, you're much younger than I am, but the AOL did AOL at Work. And the day they launched it was the day they had their famous 19-hour outage. And the guy, Mark Walsh, who ran it, was like, had sold it to all these businesses as the communications tool for a company, you know, the not email-based communications tool. And it was over in seconds. But it still was a great idea.
It is. And I suspect you'll probably mention the fact that we've recently had an outage, so I'll preempt you there because I listened to your discussion with Aaron Levy from Box, and I know that was right after that had happened. So first of all, apologies. I would have brought you socks if I didn't believe you probably already had four pair. But I don't want to make light of that at all.
Right.
I mean, it's bad enough when really important consumer communication tools go down. We don't like it when our consumer, social networks and so forth go down because they are our lifeline in some way to connect to the people we care about and the things we do. But, you know, when we're talking about work, it's absolutely critical. And the bar for us is incredibly high. I think it's important to realize, absolutely not as an excuse, but just so you know where our mindset is, frankly, if Office 365 or even Google Apps goes down, it's super frustrating. You're in the middle of doing something, you can't do it. But when Slack goes down, you can't even communicate with other people to know whether or not Slack went down.
Right.
And so we are that bottom stack for
there's
exactly nothing you can get done at work without communicating.
Right.
And, one thing I remind my team sometimes is, we're not personally saving lives, but there are literally people doing work on our platform who are aiming to and trying to report the news and trying to do all these things that are very real time in nature. So, so with that in mind, I think that, we need to be like the phone company. We need to be, we need to be, utility grade or carrier grade to some degree. And so we're invested very deeply there. In fact, this year we have, we've foregone shipping some things we're really excited about because we are shifting the majority of
as many people as we can. I think you're in a real dicey situation there. We're going to talk about that when we get back with April Underwood. Sure. She's the chief product officer at Slack. But first, a word from our sponsors.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You've heard it before. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. But it's more than just a tagline, because State Farm agents are small business owners themselves who live and work in your community. And if you're in the market for small business insurance, who better to work with than an agent who understands what it takes? State Farm agents can help you create a personalized insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. Talk to your local State Farm agent today about small business insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Wow, that guy means business.
Just an amazing player.
No, not him, the sports photographer behind him.
What?
He has a business bank account with QuickBooks Money where he earns 5% annual percentage yield. So he's scoring big on and off the field. You might even say he's the MVB.
MVB?
The most valuable business.
Making your money work harder. That's how you business differently. Intuit QuickBooks. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank. Member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
We're back with April Underwood. She's the chief product officer at Slack. We're talking just recently about an outage they had recently, but it underscores the idea of being this utility grade and being something. You guys just raised how much money?
We just raised $427
million,
give or take, at a $7.1 billion valuation.
So it's been creeping upwards. And obviously, I had interviewed lots of like Peggy Johnson before Microsoft. Others had tried to buy you for years. But you guys have been going it alone, like doing this. Mm-hmm. And you're also in the sweet spot of so many companies who have tried to do this workplace productivity stuff. Microsoft has bought a number of companies to compete with you. Google's in there. Microsoft bought LinkedIn. There's all kinds of things they're trying to do to get into this area. So you have huge competitors. And one of the things that is critically important besides being working all the time and not going down is also security and some other mm-hmm. issues. So talk a little bit about what the reasons why you guys keep moving forward as an independent company when you're thinking about that. Because, you know, there's been all people have tried to buy you. I've written about it quite a lot of times. But you guys have stuck with this idea that you can do this independently.
Yeah, well, I mean, if we thought we were 80% done with mm-hmm. what we planned to do, then, you know, then you think about things differently. But we're just, in so many ways, just getting started. I mean, mm-hmm. we've got 8 million daily active users right now. They're across 500,000 organizations, 3 million daily paid users. We've got like Capital One, and then mm-hmm. we've also got like the Jackson Hole Wildlife Refuge. Like, we mm-hmm. have this really amazing breadth of customers. Mm-hmm. Last January, when we launched Enterprise Grid, was the first time we even had a product in market that could mm-hmm. really address the needs of a company over a couple thousand employees. Mm-hmm. And since that time, we've brought tons of customers to that product. And again, like, I mean, we're what, 18 months into that? Mm-hmm. International, the product was only in English until a year ago. Mm-hmm. So we've just started to bring it, in a meaningful way to other markets. But a lot of that is about sort of audience, like how many teams in the world can actually use Slack? Mm-hmm. And we're still...
How many different kinds of teams?
Exactly. And so we're still in this like hugely expansive phase mm-hmm. of building the capabilities that we need so that more types of teams at work can use Slack. But the other thing that's happening in parallel is we talk about the fact that we're a platform. And, you know, a lot of companies talk about
being a
platform. But what you want to have in order to be a platform is you need like this really stable foundation. You need mm-hmm. to provide some service that is so broadly useful mm-hmm. that it's actually, it makes sense for users, for customers to be able mm-hmm. to make use of more capabilities on top of it. Mm-hmm. And as I described earlier, you know, communication is like the last thing before and like the operating system on your device itself.
Right.
I mean, it is just so foundational mm-hmm. To everything that people do.
Which is at the heart of Slack.
It is.
I try to explain, it's like you're talking to, I just was talking to someone who's a very well-known reporter, and he's like, should I use this Slack thing? And I'm like, you're an idiot. Like, what do you, yes, you have it like for my team. And I'm like, yeah, like we run our company on it.
Thank you. You should write some more.
No, yeah. But you do run your company on it. You do. It's an interesting thing, and it's the best so far that I've seen. I, of course, would switch in a second if I had to. We were on something else before you. What were we on? Who was your other competitor?
So HipChat has been popular.
We've
recently
chat.
Done a
What's
deal
the
with
one?
Them. Yeah.
There was another one. We moved on to Slack from... whatever it was. It was good, but you were better.
Yeah,
okay. But I'm saying you've got to like figure out foundationally what you're providing people, which is communications.
Right.
And organization.
Well, absolutely. And so communication in Slack is organized around channels. Mm-hmm. And you know, you're totally right that other people have sort of like poked at this concept mm-hmm. before, but you know, in Slack, you know, channels really sit at the center. And so channels have all of these great properties mm-hmm. To them, which are that, you know, you can join and leave them at will. You can set notifications on them so that if you need a push notification mm-hmm. every time somebody posts in a channel that is related to what's about to go to press, that you can get a push notification on any of your devices. They are searchable so that, you know, the next person who joins a team can actually benefit from the conversation discussions that have happened in the past. And it is a fundamentally different way to work. I mean, it's moving, you know, I mean, it's fundamentally different than inboxes were. But, you know, Slack's platform, and which is what I joined to work on, and now my responsibilities are much broader, but we have an amazing team working on that. Slack's platform is just absolutely core to what we're doing, which is that, you know, we launched something a few months ago that made it so that an app on our platform, like Zendesk, for mm-hmm. example, could add an action to the gear menu mm-hmm. inside Slack. And it seems relatively straightforward. But if you think about that, imagine a scenario where a customer support team is talking to a customer and they've at some point, and they're doing their work in Zendesk. Mm-hmm. And that is where they live. They also mm-hmm. communicate in Slack. But when they're getting work done, they're communicating mm-hmm. with customers, they live in Zendesk. But they need to actually share that ticket with the engineering team within an organization mm-hmm. because they believe that it's likely a bug. Well, engineers don't live in Zendesk. They live in Jira.
Right.
And so the ability for us to have this platform that allows information to flow and bite-sized workflows like this mm-hmm. to actually be executed by teams across applications, like mm-hmm. there's just, it's a huge gap.
Absolutely.
In a world in which...
Because you're switching from one to the other and they're not even communicating with each other.
Right, exactly. So Slack becomes that bus or that, mm-hmm. that common denominator. And so, you know, the ticket can be shared into the channel from Zendesk, from an employee directly in Zendesk. Somebody can see, yep, that looks like a bug. They can use this new mm-hmm. feature to be able to create a ticket in Jira. And we actually are able to facilitate that workflow. And each of those companies did one integration. They built on top of the Slack platform. They don't have to build with the N squared or whatever number of, you know, customer service and mm-hmm. engineering bug tracking tools. Mm-hmm. They're able to build into this platform. And so, you know, what we're doing with the platform is actually making it possible for customers to get more value out of every single dollar they're spending on software, mm-hmm. which is a lot. And we're creating a place where not only can they get that work done, but we're building the search capabilities on top of it that mm-hmm. it can be, you know, it can be utilized and harnessed in a way that you never could before.
You had talked about this several years ago, this developers part of it. And, you know, Twitter, that was a big thing until it wasn't, right? Where they started to create their own things. They sort of killed all the developers that were working on the platform. How do you guys look at developers? Because it's often a push me, pull you. Facebook, they had the mm-hmm. same issue. They killed most of them or many of them. They used them to grow, but then...
Yeah.
I can't imagine it's not integral to you all, though. You can't do that.
Well, absolutely. But it's structurally just so completely different.
Yeah.
We got a number of folks that work at Slack on platform that have worked on other platforms. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in consumer platforms and in consumer products in general, you already have a challenge, which is a product and a strategy challenge, which is that you want to offer the best experience around the organic content. Mm-hmm. And then you also need to get ads in front of people.
Right.
And that's already a challenge, even if there was mm-hmm. no third party involved. We don't have that dynamic with Slack.
Right.
We sell our software to teams to use at work.
Right.
So our job is to build the best software for them and to offer the best service that we possibly can for them. And we share that goal with the developers in our ecosystem. Their mm-hmm. job is to make it easier to run a restaurant, make it easier to,
get their software used.
Exactly. And so, you know, we have roughly the same business model as the majority of the developers on our platform and that, you know, a lot of SaaS applications. We have a shared interest, which is helping our customers be more productive and like really address the needs of how work has changed. And in doing that, our interests are completely aligned. And so it's not just, you know, these aren't just words. I just have to say that having worked on a number of consumer platforms, mm-hmm. there are all these hard problems. And you're mm-hmm. like, oh, how do we balance this? And mm-hmm. we basically have none of those. It's Slack, and it's really refreshing.
It must be exhausting.
God bless enterprise software. Yeah.
So when you think about the issues, the most pressing issues you have on the platform, I would assume security would be your biggest. Now, it's interesting that the consumer platforms are the ones being dinged for it this year about the Russians. Actually, the Russians just used the platforms exactly as they were built, from what I can tell. It wasn't hacking or anything like that. But in your case, you're protecting a lot of corporate information.
Yeah.
There's a lot of... So is that your biggest concern, or is I assume either that or continually being innovative to keep up with competitors, larger and more deep-pocketed competitors? How do you think about the issues around the platform?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say the thing I think about the most is a little bit different, so I'll come back to that. But I think that, so security is absolutely, it's table stakes for what we're doing. And so both the way in which we work as well as the expectations we have for developers that build apps that go into our app directory are very high. So we take an approach which is that we review those applications. We do a variety of testing around them. We make sure that our customers understand, what information is or isn't being shared with them. Mm-hmm. So that's the approach that we take, which is quite hands-on and is also just, you know, it's exactly what you would expect for given the job that we're doing. In terms of innovation, you know, I don't really worry about that much. Like we have so much further that we want to go with the product. There's so many opportunities for us to help teams be able to work together more effectively. I mean, in a world in which there's software that makes so many of the tasks that used to take up a lot of people's time so much faster, mm-hmm. From expense reporting software to design tools mm-hmm. to, you know, operations tools for supply chain, you know, like there's software for everything now. And what that means is that people have a lot more, like really spend much more of their time coordinating and collaborating, communicating with other people. Like that, that's where that, like, that's both the bottleneck, but it's also just literally where people, where the work is. And so we need to keep helping people get the full value out of what they can do with Slack. And I'd say that actually points more to, it's less about, do we have ideas? Like, do we have innovative ideas for how we can do that? We've got loads of them. The trick is that our audience has expanded really quickly, and we are, you know, so far beyond the companies that look like us now. We've got, you know, Target, and like I mentioned, Capital One, and we've got, you know, we've got these large organizations that are quite different than tech companies in Silicon Valley. And you know, within those companies, there are tons of employees that need to understand more about how to make use of a product like Slack. And it's not even so much about Slack. It's about like, how do I transition to this new way of working? It's cultural. It's about transparency. It's tactical, about just like literally how do I make use of this tool? And so that's a lot of what we're focused on, is just we've been really, really lucky that Slack has been this movement where people fight to bring it in their organizations. They start using it within their organizations. And then over time, the IT teams can see the value because it's so obvious to them. And so then it becomes, you know, an official supported tool. I want to enable more people to be able to make that case. Not every single person is prepared to make the case for why the company should work differently and use this new tool. And I think there's more we could do to help them.
So what's the biggest obstacle you face from your perspective in getting them to do this? Just using it or getting them on the platform? Because you are dealing with very small groups and very large groups, but I would assume the focus, just like at Box or anywhere else, are on the big customers.
I think it's a little bit different than Box. I mean, I can't speak to where Box's focus is, but we have a really wide breadth of customers, and in fact, and
where's the most? Where I don't even know what that is.
I mean, the most customers are smaller.
Small and medium sized.
But 65% of the Fortune 100 are paid customers of Slack.
Or there could be small uses within large corporations, right?
Absolutely,
Certain groups within groups.
It often starts there, it starts spreading. And we launched shared channels last year. Do you know what shared channels are? So shared channels are a way for you to be able to have a channel that is shared with another company. And that's increasingly important in a world in which companies don't work as islands. They work with vendors and partners, and they may do joint work with customers even at times. And so Slack can facilitate that work and bring the same benefits to your internal communication that you get there. So the biggest challenge there is, I think a little bit around this has all happened really fast for us. I mean, as a company, the product's been in market for about 4 years. You have to build the product, but you also have to build the business. We've been fortunate, like the freemium model that we approach has been working, and now we've added to it, our sales driven model for the larger companies. But then you also need to build a company. You need to build a healthy company, and you need to build the leadership, and you need to establish how we do things. And doing all three, you have to do all three things at the same time. They're dependent on each other. So I would say, the opportunities for how we help more companies understand how to get them most out of Slack, they're very, very clear. We just need to go do them.
What innovations do you think are critical that people want? Everyone bothered you for a while for response, all kinds of things. I think I tweeted a bunch, I'd like this, please. I do it to all the companies. Like, I'm still waiting for the edit function on Twitter. It would be really nice.
One area that I'm thinking a lot about right now is just, how do we make it possible for people to express themselves inside Slack in a way that that reflects the effort and hard work that they put into whatever it is that they're saying. In email culture, there's this world where you actually like start the email in like a doc or something, and you spend all this time editing it, and you get other people to review it before you like hit send, and it's this like,
gosh, you do that? I don't. Go ahead.
People do that. Okay. People do that in larger companies.
I think things and push.
Yeah. I think there's that culture, which is that if you're doing this really important work, that the way you communicate it needs to reflect.
Well, Slack has actually taken that away. People are a little too loose on Slack. They think of it as Facebook. They think of it as, it's really interesting.
Well, and there can be some real
it's not
benefits.
Your fault.
Yeah, there's cultural benefits to that, and there's actually efficiency to that as well. Mm-hmm. But one of the things you asked, sort of what are people asking for? One of the things people want is they want the tools to be able to very easily express themselves in a way that that reflects their intelligence and the amount of effort that they put into whatever it is that they're doing. And so so we added, for example, you can do Control B or Control A. You can actually start to add a little bit more of that formatting without understanding markup. That's a good example where here in our world, it can make a lot of sense to edit to format your message using markup. But as we get to 8 million daily active
and
users,
don't
10,
know, yeah.
12, 20. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't want to necessarily have to teach the entire world markup. We'd instead mm-hmm. like to give them tools that are super intuitive.
Mm-hmm. And what about when those veer into people who are on your platform, the developers too? Because some of it you're going to have to own yourselves. What are the critical things you need to own yourself?
I mean, the critical thing that we need to own is the core communication layer.
And channel level.
That's right. The channels, the ability to communicate, the ability to set notifications on top of it. I mean, those are many of just the core elements. Mm-hmm. All of our platform developers get to plug into that mm-hmm. and they get to play along with mm-hmm. that. So for example, you know, we added a status. So you can say, you know, I'm at the doctor or whatever, mm-hmm. and you can pick an emoji and you can mm-hmm. say where you are. We expose that via the API because if you are an enterprise tool that helps people manage their vacation, mm-hmm. then, you know, there's the opportunity to programmatically pre-populate that, mm-hmm. for example. Mm-hmm. So generally we don't have as many hard questions like that. I think, you know, we have our own calling features, for example, but we also have all of the major calling providers mm-hmm. have apps on top of the Slack app directory, and we've made it possible for teams to select one of those as the default. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, so we are a platform, like, you know, through and through. And so when we build those new capabilities beyond like the most foundational things right. that frankly, it would be really hard for somebody mm-hmm. else to do on top of our platform. We expose those along to third parties as well.
And then what is the one thing you would like to see on the platform? What are the one thing people are asking for from how people work on the platform?
Yeah, that's a great question because it's really, we have such a diverse audience that mm-hmm. I wouldn't say there's necessarily one thing, mm-hmm. But I would say that simple things go a long way. So, you know, Concur, which is owned by SAP, them building, you know, along with other tools like Workday, where 80, 90, 95% of the employees interact mm-hmm. with that software in a fairly narrow way, and as it should be. There's a small percentage of the company that make use of all of the vast majority of the features, the configuration, the provisioning, mm-hmm. all of these, you know, business rules, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But most people interact with it in that they get a notification and they need to take action upon it. And bringing those simple things into Slack have been some of the things that people have been most excited about to date, including things like, I think it was just last week, very recently, we have launched the next stage of our integration with Google Drive. Mm-hmm. And so if you live in Slack and then you check your email and you realize somebody had a comment to you in a Google Doc mm-hmm. 4 hours earlier, that's not a great experience.
Right.
And it's not a great experience from mm-hmm. How you feel about Google Apps or how you right. feel about Slack. So you know, we've worked with Google in a really great partnership we have. And so now you can receive those comments inside Slack and you can actually reply to them from within Slack. So that's an example where, you know, Google has obviously done the math. They don't see more value if you spend more time looking at the mm-hmm. Google Doc. Like, we right. are all we're trying to help companies right. be productive and efficient. So there's not this like eyeballs and time on site
right.
and that sort of stuff
yeah.
at all.
No.
And so those simple things go a long way because mm-hmm. they're useful by a really wide audience of people. And they allow you to get through some of those distractions
right.
that help you focus on deeper work.
Right. What's interesting is the whole focus on text on Slack more than anything else. Even though you add the emojis, you add the photos and stuff like that, it really is a text-based system still, you know, it's sort of email if you took it to the nth level kind of thing. I don't know how to describe it. You know, do you know what I mean? Because you really do deal in text quite a bit.
You do, but...
Also spreadsheets and stuff, that things that are attached to it.
Sure, but I mean, there are use cases out there. Mm-hmm. I mean, like I mentioned earlier, the Jackson Hole Wildlife mm-hmm. Refuge, they go out in the field and they take photos,
yeah.
whatever photos they need to take, and then they post them to mm-hmm. channels. So actually, you know, I mean, there are lots of design organizations as well where there's a lot of sharing of photos
right.
or even video. You know, so I mean, like anything, it depends on the use case, which is why we need to be, you know, as
right,
flexible
to have all
as possible.
Those things. Yeah. All right, we're here talking with April Underwood about Slack, which is a product. How do you guys call it? Productivity tool?
It's a collaboration
hub
for teams.
Oh, God, I like that. We're going to talk more about where Slack is going and also where Silicon Valley is going with her when we get back. We're here with April Underwood. She is the chief product officer at Slack. I do want to talk about, you did the angels thing. You did it with all the Twitter people. It was a lot of women at Twitter, correct?
It's all women.
All women. And Explain what that is.
So hashtag angels is a group of six former executives at Twitter.
Mm-hmm. Chloe Slayton's in there, yeah.
And we worked together at Twitter over the course of those 5 years. And as some of us were thinking about what we were going to do next, we all had an interest in angel investing. And So we have this thesis that if we came together as a group, we would have more to offer the companies that we backed, because we would do that for one another anyway. Mm-hmm. But I think, frankly, angel investing is a little bit like, you know, it's a little bit of a not well understood sort of, you know, job, as it were, in practice. And so, you know, we just wanted to make that explicit, which is that if, you know, Katie Stanton or Chloe Sladen called me and said, hey, I'm going to back this company, like, would you be interested in investing with me? Will you check them out? Tell me what you think. I would have done that anyway, but the six of us decided to come together. It was also a little bit of thesis that if you write a Medium post and say that you're angel investors, then you're angel investors. Right. And I would say that that thesis proved true, which was really amazing. So right after we, you know, announced, we started, you know, seeing deal flow, not just from founders, but from sometimes the firm's seed stage and later looking, you know, to see if we would want to join them on deals. Mm-hmm. And then we also heard from another audience, which was a lot of women, mostly operators, but also some of the female investors as well, who are like just glad that we were there and like, how can we get involved? How can we help? Like, and also, you know, especially amongst operators, like I would like to do this and I have no idea how to do it. I see the men that I've worked with doing it, but I don't know how to get involved. And so we started bringing people together. And so we've created some community around it. We've held a bunch of events. Incidentally, the venture firms have been very happy to partner with us and on many of those events. But, you know, so we've done all that. We've backed, I looked in the spreadsheet last night. We've backed, you know, like 70 or 80 companies between the six of us. You know, writing our own checks. We didn't raise a fund. So we're making those decisions on our own. But the other thing that we've started doing is talking a little bit about what we call the gap table and just trying to bring more education to the industry. We're focused on women, but generally to the way that the cap table works and the way that that distributes wealth in the industry and why one might want to do something like angel investing, but also potentially just have a better understanding of sort of their day job and that role. And
why did I don't, this is an obvious question. Why did you do it with all women? Because you're obviously making a statement about that issue.
Yeah.
You're one of the few top executives. I try very hard on this podcast, but ultimately you run out of people. I know, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like it's hard. It's harder. How do you think you handle that at work? Does that become something you have to focus on over Stuart or anybody else there? This is Stuart Butterfield, who's the CEO.
Yeah. I mean, why we started Angels with All Women is oddly enough that I think the other five women I started with are mm-hmm. really damn smart.
Yeah.
And really good.
There's no Adam Bain in there. Let's, you know, like
he's smart too.
Yeah.
But there is a camaraderie and a kinship that comes with being, perhaps the only woman in the room, in your own room, and knowing those other women who are having that experience. Absolutely. I mean, at every company I've worked at, I've come away with, a number of connections that are quite deep with other women there. And there's no doubt it's due to shared experience. You know, I feel really fortunate today to get to be a leader at a company that is focused on, that has focused on diversity and inclusion since early on. I mean, founders and just people in the world often ask me, you know, what should we do about D&I? And of course, you know, the truth is I don't consider myself an expert in it, but because I'm a woman, I do get asked about that. And, you know, the main thing that we #angels would tell our founders is to start early, you know, start focusing in on it early. And I think that, you know, Slack is, you know, it was a factor in joining Slack that Slack is a company that has done that. They'd already done the first report and offered transparency into the employee base when I joined. And, you know, we've quadrupled since then and we continue to do it.
What kind of grade would you give yourself?
Slack?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're tough graders on ourselves. You know, I'm not necessarily pegged to a single number, but what I will say is we've always focused on it and there's always more work to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not only do we want to have an employee base that's as representative as we possibly can of our customer base, of the populations of places where we have offices, like all of that sort of stuff, but we definitely want to avoid Slack being a place where people would decide to exit from the industry. Mm-hmm. And that's the piece I think a lot of companies are thinking about now, which is like, even if you manage to do the work to get the right people in place, how can you make sure that they can
stay.
Be successful?
That's the absolute problem.
Yeah.
I mean, besides, I think people get the issue of recruiting people. I think getting people to stay is, I think, or providing management structure around them to be able to succeed.
Sure. And look at my career. I mean, I have you know, made changes over time. And I wouldn't say that that was directly the factor, mm-hmm. that there was like some environment along the way that was really bad. But there have been times at which it has felt like the growth opportunities for
weren't
me
there.
Sat outside of the company.
Right. Has that changed in Silicon Valley? Not just for women, but people of color and from your perspective? It's not, you can't lump everybody into one group, but you can. Can and can't. It's a similar outsider experience.
I think that's one of the biggest things that I've come to a deeper realization about over the last few years is that actually you can't really. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, being a woman in tech for so long, I felt like an underdog. Mm-hmm. I felt like everybody else was having a conversation mm-hmm. or like knew a way of doing things, et cetera. And I didn't. And I mean, it's funny. I mean, I feel like I, in many ways, assimilated to mm-hmm. the best that I could, you know,
right.
try to be one of the guys, try to be one of the guys, you know, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. But I do think that, I mean, for reasons that are definitely coming from a dark mm-hmm. timeline in our country and in the world, you know, time's up, me too. Like, I do think a lot of this is being brought to light right now, but I'm not convinced that the impact or the ways in which it's improving are evenly distributed. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a big open question for us. And I think mm-hmm. that there's a lot of people that are speaking up and bringing this to attention. And I think mm-hmm. the fact that even I have the awareness that, you know, it's not quite right for me to think of myself as an underdog anymore, not only mm-hmm. because I'm the chief product officer at Slack, but because actually maybe things have improved for the group that I'm in mm-hmm. much more than they have for other groups. And I think that you can get into that sort of underdog mindset, and it can be a little bit hard to flip
the
switch.
Well, it's also having a responsibility to actually be able to do something at a
Absolutely.
Company. And then I think it gets heavily put on women at the top to do something versus everybody to do mm-hmm. something, which is interesting. I mean, and being aware of those conversations that people aren't being part of. It's a really interesting question. One of the reasons I became a boss is because I wanted to run the conversation. So I'll just run it. And then you can't have other conversations except the ones I decide on, which I think matter. I think it just does matter. So when you think about that, I want to get to the bigger issue right now, because Slack's not as dragged into this, but the image of tech has gotten terrible now. All the stuff that's going on at Facebook and Google and other places has really dragged down the concept. How do you look at how tech is looked at? Because you've worked in all these various different areas. Yeah.
I have to take a step back, and I can't help but think a little bit like, could this have been predicted?
Mm-hmm.
And
yes. Sorry, I'm going to answer that for you, but go ahead.
Well, that's great, and right. I wish maybe you did, I do think that just where we were in the world in 2012. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. you think about all the amazing things that were happening, like we're getting ACA, and my numbers, the exact years may be off, but mm-hmm. during that period, mm-hmm. like we're getting ACA, gay marriage is being legalized.
Right.
There were like all these, like people were getting maternity leave benefits.
Right,
like
there were a number
of amazing things that were happening.
Yes, 100%.
And even if people had run like tabletop scenarios of like, here are all the things that
could
possibly happen.
Yeah, yeah.
This would have been like the, like where we are now is the dark timeline.
There
so like a, we, it would have been a 0.00001% chance that we would have ended up exactly where we are today.
No, you're right. There's a paragraph in the New York Times today that I never thought I'd read in the New York Times. It was like Mr. Trump, who worked on The Apprentice, and Stormy Daniels, who made this movie. And they watched Shark Tank before they had sex. And you're like, this is in the New York Times. Like, are you kidding me? Like,
yeah. How did we get here?
Yeah. I think that's what all of us are asking.
That's what all of us are asking. So I asked that. I mean, as it relates to Slack, you know, I'm not trying to sort of dodge it for us because I think every company in tech should be thinking about this, but it really hasn't because we're building tools for teams at work.
Yeah.
And
I'm sure Russians use your service, but they really can't impact elections doing it. Who knows?
We're not building a platform
that enables that.
But but the thing I do want to say about that, about all of this, is maybe I still bleed a little bit blue for my 5 years at Twitter.
Right.
But you know, when you're really, really close to these things and you're having to make hard decisions about what to do in a specific scenario, mm-hmm. and that's what you do every day, you have a lot more information than the rest of us. And you know about some hard decision that we made in some different country somewhere else in the world that like none of us in America like even care about right mm-hmm. now. And so I think that, I think that that is part of the practice of having to make some of these hard decisions mm-hmm. is that like you are very, very close to it. You know, now I'm a little I mean, I'm further away because I've been, you know, gone from Twitter for 3 years. But I think in general, I think all of these companies, I do think they have very smart people who actually care very deeply about this issue. Yeah. And I wish that the punchline could be like, and I figured out what they need to do. And it's A, B, and C.
Right.
I mean, that's the one thing that gives me comfort is just like, I think we're going to get there. Like, I think we will find the right way to tackle these problems, but I think it's going to take some time and I think it's going to be painful.
I do think it's the damage that has been done in the process of their learning experiences. Do you know what
Understood.
I mean? And it's an irresponsibility that, and you don't want to be their scold, but on some levels it's, they took the money, they took the fame, they took everything else and they didn't fix this one thing that is causing all kinds of pain. You know what I mean? And then when you point it out to them, they're like, don't be mean to me. Or I tried my best. And, you know, I try my best is really not an answer I particularly like. You know, like I get it, but you're not children and it's not, you don't get an A for effort kind of stuff. And so, I mean,
these are tough times.
What would you do if you were running Twitter?
You know, I think, I consider myself to be like fairly self-effacing and like, I think it'd be completely insane to think that I have some answer that smart people that have been thinking about it don't have. I think we're at a really interesting point as a country and in the world, which is that the tools may to some extent be against, I mean, ahead of where we are in terms of regulation and in terms of, you know, the
psyche.
Definitely the psyche. I mean, I think also, you know, one of the biggest things that is most jarring about all this is to find out that this was always here. Like this hate was always there. And now it's had the opportunity.
Tools.
Yeah, exactly. But the thing is, it also, those tools also create an opportunity for like this amazing slew of candidates that are, you know, running for election to be able to reach people. And all I mean by that is that there were a lot of really great things that had come out of these tools. And then we were in this period where it like looked like the world, like we were through the hard part of like human history. Like we were really punching through in a number of ways. And now we end up here and it actually it turns out like that, you know, I don't know, the quote bad guys are able to use the tools just as well or better than the good guys. And that's, so I don't have an answer for you.
Yeah.
But
it's complicated.
But how depressing.
No, it is. It's interesting. I just did an interesting podcast with Jaron Lanier and he was talking about that never before has all of humanity been able to talk to each other and maybe we're not ready for it. Like, and I was like, I think you've really got it. Like I really... You know, I mean, I think it's an unprecedented experiment on humanity.
Oh, absolutely.
To be doing this. But let's finish up talking about Slack. Let's get back to Slack. So when you do that, you also are trying to free corporations. And so I'd love to get your thoughts just briefly in the last few minutes we have of where businesses are going and how work is changing and how what you guys do to contribute to that. Because there's definitely, in this use case scenario, it's pretty much all good. Like, it makes a better corporation. People talk more. It eases, it you know, it greases the wheels and things like that. And there's not, I can't think of a huge amount of downside for Slack, except people use it a lot and spend a lot of time on it. It's a little slightly addictive, but not that bad. It's not as bad as other things. Talk about where you think work is going and how you think of that, because that's got to be at the heart, the theories around that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, messaging is the default mode of communication. I mean, it is for us, but also, like, roughly half the workforce will be millennials by 2020, and definitely as that audience evolves. So you've got that piece of it. You've got the cultural aspects that I already alluded to, which I've literally lived myself, which is that companies have realized that more transparency, matching their tools to sort of the implicit organizational structure rather than like hard coding them to the explicit organizational
and
structure.
Hiding away information.
Exactly. Leads to better outcomes. And so there's sort of like the macro trends around what users expect and that they expect to use software at work that they can figure out how to use without taking a training module. Like, I think that, like, that's a pretty clear bar that most enterprise software has not met. Yeah, exactly. So
it's like 2 years.
So expectations from users are higher. Companies believe that there's something to this idea of giving their employees access to the context that they need to be able to do their best work. You layer on top of that the fact that, you know, the number of software tools is just exploding. So this proliferation of enterprise software, you know, what it means is that people have the best tools they've ever had, but they don't all work with each other. And they have more access to information than they've ever had before. So they need ways to to control that and to, right. and to you know, figure out how to harness it. And so that's where I think things are going. I think that you know, people are going to be expecting to use a suite of tools at work that are easy to use, that work with each other. Mm-hmm. I think that a number of other companies, you know, I would include Atlassian with what they do mm-hmm. for developer tools, but I would also include, you know, Zoom. We are, mm-hmm. you know, Zoom customers at Slack mm-hmm. and they've built a really great product there. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly everything that's being done at
this
Box and Dropbox and
yeah.
so forth. Yeah. So I mean, this whole suite of tools, they're run by a bunch of independent companies, but they need a place to work together.
Teacher, right?
And so I think the future is one in which people will have access to the information that they need to do their work in an unprecedented way. They're going to have control over how that work interrupts them and how that information is presented to them that allows them to do their best work and to stay focused and really do the work that only humans can do, mm-hmm. The creative work, the collaborative and communicative work. And they're going to do it across just an ever-growing number of tools. And mm-hmm. so, you know, that's what we see. And, mm-hmm. and that's
from
why,
independent companies.
Yeah. And that's what we see. And when people start working in this way, they see results. Like, mm-hmm. you know, 90% of our paid customers, you know, report that, like, you know, that communication is easier because mm-hmm. because they use Slack. They, you know, like 2/3 of them, you know, report that they're more productive. I'd like those numbers to be 110%.
Right.
But I think that, like, we're off to a good start. And so it is a fundamental change in the way that people are working, and it's going to take some time, but we're going to be driving it.
All right. Where are you going to be working next? Not Microsoft, I don't think.
No plans. I think I've got plenty of work cut out for me. I have the best job that I've ever had in my career, and mm-hmm. I think I also have the best product job in the industry. So yeah. So I'm good.
All right. Well, thank you so much, April. This has been a really fascinating discussion, and it was great talking to you. Thank you for coming on the show.
You too.
If you enjoyed the interview as much as I did, be sure to subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. You can also find more episodes of Recode Decode on Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you didn't like the interview, don't just Slack me. I'm not going to respond at all. But in any way, or just want to say hi and tweet at me. I'm at Kara Swisher on Twitter. Now that you're done with this, go check out our latest episode of Recode Media. You can find that show wherever you found this one. Thanks for listening to this episode of Recode Decode. And thanks to our editor, Joel Robbie, and our producer, Eric Johnson. I'll be back here on Monday. Tune in then.